From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation, and I'm in her chair this week. On The Mary Tyler Moore Show, TV producer and writer Alan Burns took us inside a TV station. His show, Lou Grant, was set at a big city newspaper, and it seems only natural that Burns would turn his attention to radio. Public radio, no less. On this edition of Fresh Air, Alan Burns talks about his new TV series, FM. Also today, I speak with novelist Don DeLillo. In his novel, Libra, he paints an imaginary conspiracy of coincidence that leads Lee Harvey Oswald to assassinate President Kennedy. Rock historian Ed Ward takes on our rosy memories of Woodstock. And book writer John Leonard reviews The Afternoon of the Writer by Austrian novelist Peter Handke. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. President Bush said today there's a good likelihood that American hostages in Lebanon could come home if Iran wanted them released, but he acknowledged they are no closer to freedom today despite an intense diplomatic effort. Bush discussed the hostage situation in a half-hour news conference on the eve of his departure for a three-week vacation in Kennebunkport, Maine. He promised that one day after his Labor Day return to Washington, he would unveil a new anti-drug program. He said the program would require more federal spending, but not higher taxes, adding that the money would be diverted from other programs. The leader of South Africa's National Party, F.W. de Klerk, has been sworn in as acting president, following yesterday's resignation of P.W. Botha. De Klerk pledged to build a new South Africa, but also warned anti-apartheid activists against any attempt to disrupt the upcoming elections. Mike Woolridge reports.
Speaking at a news conference after the swearing-in ceremony, Mr. de Klerk said he did not think the highly public row with Mr. Botha and the suddenness of his departure from office would have a negative effect on the National Party's chances in the election, contrary to the claims of the opposition parties, who are posing the biggest threat to nationalist rule in 40 years. He claimed the opposition had been exploiting the division of power between Mr. Botha and himself over the past 6 months, and the fact that this had now been resolved could help the party. On future policy, Mr. de Klerk reiterated the central pledge of the National Party's election manifesto to create a South Africa in which, he said, all people would participate in decisions affecting their lives at all levels of government, but in a way that ensured there could be no domination, the party's bloc against black majority rule.
The BBC's Mike Woolridge. President Wojciech Jaruzelski called for a joint meeting of top leaders from all political camps in Poland as he expressed concern over the growing instability in the country, resulting from a governmental crisis. Jane Dobia reports from Warsaw.
Jaruzelski is appealing to Poland's major political leaders to find a rational solution to the country's leadership dilemma. Yesterday, Communist Prime Minister Czesław Kiszczak resigned after failing to form a coalition with Solidarity. Since then, opposition efforts to form a government headed by Solidarity have gained momentum. Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa announced that he would take the post of prime minister if the people want him. Meanwhile, Solidarity's stance toward the Communist Party has softened. Previously, Lech Wałęsa said he wanted to form a government only with two minor parties, the Peasants and the Democrats. However, today, an aide to Wałęsa said Solidarity would accept communists in two key cabinet posts as ministers of defense and the interior. For National Public Radio, I'm Jane Dobia in Warsaw.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 8 points today to close at 2686.65. Advances led decline 7-6 on volume of 149 million shares. This is NPR News. The State Department said today the body of Texas Representative Mickey Leland and 15 others killed in a plane crash in western Ethiopia have been recovered and moved to a temporary morgue in Addis Ababa. A Pentagon plane carrying a pathologist and mortuary equipment left Washington for Addis Ababa to help examiners already in Ethiopia. The Communication Workers of America remain on strike against four regional telephone companies today. Telephone workers in the mid-Atlantic states have rejected one company's efforts to resume negotiations. Health benefits remain a central issue. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
Negotiators for Bell Atlantic are trying to get union members to pay some deductibles on their health insurance, as well as half the premiums for some family members. Union spokesman Bill Bickers says the CWA has sent the offer back to the company.
They put back on the table roughly the same proposal that was on the table Saturday night a week ago when the strike started. There were a couple of modifications, none of any significance. In fact, some of the company's demands were worse than what they were when the strike started.
CWA members on the East and West Coasts are in the second week of their strike, and Midwestern Union members walked out 4 days ago. Only one of the regional phone companies, 9X, has agreed to resume informal talks with the union. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
A private research group reported today that fewer than one in three jobless workers receives unemployment insurance in an average month last year. The figure ties the lowest rate ever recorded. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities said that of the 6.7 million workers unemployed in an average month last year, only 2 million of them were getting benefits. The center, which calculated the figures from the U.S. Department of Labor data, called the low extent of coverage an ominous indicator of what might happen if the economy weakens further. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Sedge Thompson, sitting in for Terry Gross, who's on holiday. There's a new situation comedy premiering this week, and it's in a setting familiar to all of us listening to Radio Free Konyaspyty, a public radio station. The TV series called FM was co-created by my guest Alan Burns, who's worked with MTM Productions ever since 1970, when he and James Brooks created the Mary Tyler Moore Show. Burns went on to co-produce the spin-offs, Rhoda and Lou Grant. These shows presented new kinds of characters on television that reflected the changing times. Mary was a single working woman in her 30s. Rhoda divorced her husband in the fourth season of her show. And Lou Grant drew material from many social issues, including homelessness and labor strikes. Lou Grant was canceled in 1982 after the star, Ed Asner, publicly supported humanitarian aid for the people of El Salvador. Burns' new show, FM, airs this Thursday on NBC. It stars Robert Hayes as the program director of a listener-supported public radio station in Washington, D.C. In the first segment, we meet some of the characters, such as the mellifluous classical music announcer who doubles as the host of the reggae show.
This is WGEO-FM, National Public Radio for Georgetown and the greater Washington area, where weekday nights at 8 you can hear me, Quentin Lamoureux, and the Classics Shelf. But now...
Hi, ho, Reggae Regulars! This is the mighty Dr. Cure. We're going to spin some wicked one for you today. So for the next 2 hours, kick back in your hammock and don't worry, be happy!
Thank you very much for coming and being on Fresh Air today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
The show was set in a public radio station, and a lot of the Mary Tyler Moore productions, the MTM productions, such as the show in Minneapolis set at WJM and in Cincinnati, right. WKRP, and Lou Grant at a newspaper, and now this one at WGEO, an NPR station in Washington, D.C., are set at kind of marginal operations in the broadcasting or the newspaper world. What was it about public radio that attracted you as a setting for this comedy?
I'm tempted to say public radio is marginal, but I don't think that's true.
It must be mainstream enough to put it on TV.
Well, I think NBC has their questions about how mainstream public radio is. I know that when we broached the subject to Brandon Tartikoff, who is the celebrated president of NBC, he was a little skeptical, I think, as to whether people who watch TV listen to NPR and vice versa. And I think we tried to convince him that there is a great deal of comedy in this, that perhaps we can educate each other a little bit about NPR, about television and vice versa, that there are certainly... there's a huge television audience that probably doesn't watch NPR that might be attracted to it as a result of, I hope, as a result of watching this program. People who just honestly don't know it's even there and should. I know that Dan and I, Dan Wilcox, when we came up with this idea, it was simply because in our own car radios, we realized that when we weren't listening to tapes, what we listened to was the local NPR affiliate here in Los Angeles, which is KCRW.
Did you go down to the station and observe the
operations? Yeah, we spent a great deal of time. I've been listening, I think, to KCRW for 10 years probably, and had some vague notion that it broadcast out of a basement somewhere on the university campus here. and which is true. It comes from Santa Monica College. It's in the basement of the cafeteria building. When Dan and I arrived to visit there for the first time, we were given a map and detailed instructions on how to find it, and it still took us 20 minutes. But when we got down there into the bowels of this building, here is this really first-class radio station with a lot of the state-of-the-art equipment. We were just amazed that it's as modern and as good a facility as it is. But what struck us most and why we thought we were really onto something when we visited there was the sort of passion that the people who work there have for what they're doing. Certainly nobody who works in public radio does it for the money, so you must do it for another reason. And I think passion is a very precious commodity. When you're doing drama or comedy, if the people that you're writing about are passionate about what they do, I think that comes across.
The audiences for a lot of the MTM production shows, which have included Hill Street Blues and St. Elsewhere, Lou Grant, the Bob Newhart Show, and the Mary Tyler Moore Show, have always drawn an educated and well-to-do audience, which has been often different from the mass audience to meet the needs of mass market advertisers. So some of these shows have always run into ratings difficulties, have been canceled and so forth. Certainly that's a characteristic of being educated that public radio stations and their audiences share with some of the viewers of these MTM productions. How did you make an argument with the networks in this time of declining television audience that setting it at a public radio station would work?
Well, I think we simply had to convince them it was going to have an audience appeal, that it was going to be funny. Curiously enough, they did not ask us to lowbrow it at any point or make it broader or anything like that. They were interested in the same values we were, which surprised us a bit. I argue with you a little bit that the MTM shows were too intellectual for the masses, so to speak, because certainly the Mary Tyler Moore Show, with which I was associated for 7 years, had a very large audience. Lou Grant, for all its topicality, was a top 10 show a good deal of the time that it was on the air.
Well, shows, for instance, like Hill Street Blues were saved by great audience pressure. The shows were to be canceled because they weren't getting the ratings.
I think Hill Street Blues was saved by the fact that in its first year it won about 9 Emmys, which had an effect on the network, and they were able to parlay that into publicity, which got them a larger audience. They really stayed with that show for a long time when it was very marginal. They, meaning NBC, stayed with it for a good long time. I'm not afraid of being too smart for the television audience. I think the audience is hungry for things that are smarter than the networks are willing to give them credit for. For example, there are a couple of shows right now that are doing rather well that I don't think are aiming low. One of them is Wonder Years. Another is Murphy Brown. And the audience that you speak of, by the way, that smart, affluent audience, is after all who the advertiser is going after.
One of the characteristics of shows that you've written and co-created and produced has been the establishment of a strong woman character, Mary Tyler Moore's character, the women characters that have reflected, social change and attitudes. Has this been something that you have directly sought to do, or just something that's evolved out of, say, that you were writing for Mary Tyler Moore?
No, when Jim Brooks and I, who was my co-creator and co-producer on that show and a couple of spin-offs from it, Rhoda and Lou Grant, Jim and I created the Mary Show. We didn't have any particular ideas at that moment about feminism. We sort of got lucky with that. we rode the crest of feminism was just beginning to happen in this country, and we hired a lot of women writers early on because they were good writers, not because they were women, but because there were some women that we knew that we wanted to have associated with the show, who were very sensitized about what was going on, and they kind of, in a way, led us into it, and we didn't resist. It seemed like something that was happening.
Well, I'd like to ask you more about politics and television when we come back. My guest is television producer Alan Burns. He's won 8 Emmys during the 25 years he's worked in television. He was the co-creator and co-producer of The Mary Tyler Moore Show, Rhoda and Lou Grant, amongst many others. His new sitcom is called FM, and it's set in a public radio station. The series will preview this Thursday. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Alan Burns, writer and television producer. His new sitcom called FM will be shown this Thursday. One of your productions was about a character named Lou Grant, newspaper editor, and it was portrayed by Ed Asner, who was outspoken on topics, political topics, in the course of the show, but also as an individual, politically active. And after a press conference announcing that he was sending medical aid to victims of the El Salvador junta, there was a great campaign and hue and cry to either get rid of him personally or sink the show, and there was a pressure, and it worked. Had you ever seen anything like this in your time in television or anything since?
No, I hadn't seen anything like it before. It was very frightening, actually, what happened to Ed. I don't know whether it was very well publicized, but there were death threats against Ed. We had armed guards on our soundstage for a good long time. Ed could not go anywhere without a guard with him. It was a horrible, horrible thing. Suddenly, America's favorite foxy uncle, which, you know, Ed was, Lou Grant was a beloved character. Suddenly, there were certain people who tried to make him into the Red Menace. And I have no doubt that was the reason that the show was canceled. I challenge you to name another series that was ever canceled when it was in the top 10. So the reasons were purely political, and I think it may have been that Mr. Paley at that point just got fed up with the amount of mail that was crossing his desk, or maybe thought that Ed was not being playing things the network way. He was being a bad boy, and therefore they should lop off his head for it. But it was grossly unfair, and Ed had a very difficult time for the next few years after that. And then MTM, of course, had 5 years then of a show which they wanted to sell into syndication. Well, it was impossible. They just couldn't sell the show in the syndication because it had the stigma on it as being this left-wing show. The curious thing is that the character of Lou Grant was a rather right-wing guy. And so the charge that the show had a liberal orientation, you know, could have been true to a certain extent, because most of us, you know, to be honest, most of us who were behind the scenes in writing have had sort of a liberal bent. But the curious thing is that our main character was not a liberal. But it remains an enigma. This show that won 26 Emmys, a Peabody Award. I mean, I can't tell you how many Humanitas prizes and things like that, that suddenly, when it was available for syndication, nobody wanted it.
Political attitudes are rampant at most public radio stations. Often people are drawn to work in public radio because they have a chance to speak perhaps out of the mainstream that they can't do in conventional television, radio, and press. So when you sit down to write an episode of FM set at a public radio station, do you fret about these kinds of political issues? Do you want to try and keep them in a light vein? Or are you afraid that there'll be a character who might develop in a Lou Grant, Ed Asner kind of direction?
Well, we're not making an effort to make this a political show by any means. But if politics seems appropriate, we're not going to shy away from it. There is a character on the show who, a Lebanese comedian, who does a satire show, which he calls Capital Punishment. You know, we've gone after, you know, I'm not terribly proud of going after Dan Quayle, but we did.
He's a big target.
It seems like an easy target. But I think we did something extremely funny in the Dan Quayle that will be on our third show. So we do those kinds of things, but they are not what the show is about. The show is really about, as the Mary Tyler Moore Show was about, the people who populate this radio station, as the Mary Show was about the people who populated the WJM or the newsroom in WJM. It is really about the way people relate. It's a character comedy. So, you know, if along the way we can make our political points, we'd like to, and because it allows us to be somewhat topical.
My guest is television producer Alan Burns, who has a new show called FM that he's co-produced, co-created, and co-written. It'll be airing this Thursday. There's one aspect of public radio that you noticed about the underwriting credits. And in fact, you deal with the particular jargon of an underwriting credit. And I'd like to hear an example of this scene.
I'm Ted Costas, and this is Long Day's Journey into Lunch, made possible this morning by a grant from Modudyne Microchips. Have you tasted any microchips lately? Well, folks, have you noticed how flavorless they are? Well, I bet you haven't eaten a Modudyne. They're mouth-watering and 100% cholesterol-free, and now available in zesty jalapeno.
You have an ear for detail, the kinds of nuance that goes into the whole setup of the operation of a radio station. Were underwriting credits something that have always stood out for you? The inanity of some of them?
Of course. And when we went to KCRW and talked to Ruth Hirschman, who's the general manager there, she said that's one of the big bugaboos of what she does, is how to write these underwriting credits so they don't come out as commercials for the companies that are the corporations generally that are underwriting. Because they get very close to the line at times. And also, she said, a lot of their copy makes them their own worst enemies. You know, the pedantic quality of some of the writing that comes to them. You almost gag on what you have to read, but it's there.
Your career started out first as an NBC page, and then you went to work for Jay Ward, the creator of Bullwinkle.
Yeah, I did work on that. And that was one of the happier credits in my career, I think. As a matter of fact, you know, my kids get more mileage out of that, or did, than all the other credits combined for which I won all those Emmys. The Bullwinkle and Rocky and His Friends and Dudley Do Right stuff has always gotten... it always gets a wonderful reaction, by the way. We filmed this show in front of an audience. And
you film FM in front of an audience?
Excuse me? FM, yes. And when the man who does the warm-up for the show mentions my credits, they usually yawn. But when you come to Bullwinkle, they all start cheering. So, I mean, there is for a show that wasn't on the air all that long, and it was so long ago, now it was 18, 20 years ago, it sure has maintained a terrifically loyal core of fans.
There was a quality about Bullwinkle. It was so wonderfully bizarre and off the wall. Have you ever had such freedom since? Do you feel that freedom in doing sitcoms now?
Well, you know, Jay Ward, who was the producer of Rocky and His Friends and Bullwinkle, always encouraged us to write to please ourselves, which I think was the greatest lesson I learned. And I've always tried to do that. I mean, to one degree or another, you have pressures that don't permit you to do that as much as you would like. But to not underestimate your audience has always been a very important clue to me. And Jay gave us that freedom and said, I mean, obviously, you know, those of your listeners who watched Bullwinkle or Rocky know that there was a lot of satire in it, and there was a lot of stuff that was just going to go over the kids' heads. And we're a bunch of, you know, 25 to 50-year-old men, I guess, in that case, writing these shows. And you had to do something to keep yourself amused, and that was it.
You were
the animation would be the part that would keep the kids amused, and there would always be some silly stuff in them. But you did stuff that was we made each other laugh with it, and that was what was important. And I think that's what we try to do. I've always tried to do in these shows we've done on MTM, and I think we've been successful with that by and large.
Your show is opening here in the midst of August, and the first five episodes will carry you into September. What are the strengths of opening at this time of year? Will it have momentum to carry you on through? Is it something you...
Sedge, I haven't a clue. I mean, I don't know why we're on this time of year, but we're accepting it. It's sort of a fait accompli. It wouldn't be my choice. Brandon Tartikoff claims that he is trying to prove that there is no season for television. I'm not sure he's right, but he's trying to make a point that you can bring on a show at any time, and if you promote it properly and advertise it properly, it will find its audience. Maybe he's right. I hope so. I mean, this is a lot of work and effort has gone into these shows. I've never had a network guy say this to me. He said, you got to get good reviews on this one. That's news. I mean, usually they don't care about that. In this instance, I think he's under some pressure to put on some better programming, I think. He's gotten criticized lately, I think, for the fact that NBC's sights seem to have been lowered from those days of Hill Street Blues and Cheers when it first started and St. Elsewhere. So I think he's under some pressure to get some good reviews, and he wants this show to get them. But I've never had a network chief tell me that before.
Well, I want to thank you for coming in and talking with us about FM and your work. Thanks very much for coming in on Fresh
Air. Thank you, Sedge.
Alan Byrne's new sitcom for NBC is called FM. It stars Robert Hayes as the program director of a listener-supported radio station in Washington, D.C. The series will preview this Thursday evening on NBC and begin in a regular Wednesday night time slot on August 23rd. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with astronomer and science writer Timothy Ferris. Along with Carl Sagan, he produced the record of music and sounds from the Earth that's carried on the Voyager spacecraft. The Voyager will pass near Neptune on August 24th. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. President Kennedy was assassinated more than 25 years ago. Novelist Don DeLillo knows his sensibilities as a writer were shaped by that killing. His novels deal with government cover-ups and public distrust. DeLillo's book, Libra, weaves a web of fate and coincidence around the assassination. Coming up, a talk with Don DeLillo. Also, the world may have called it 3 days of peace and music, but to rock historian Ed Ward, Woodstock was 3 days of bad acts and 20 years of hype. He'll explain what he means. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Afternoon of the Writer. It's Austrian writer Peter Handke's introspective look at the writer's craft. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. President Bush said today that he could not claim American hostages in Lebanon were any closer to freedom, despite an intense diplomatic effort, but there was a good likelihood that they could come home if Iran wanted them released. He said there were limits on possible military action to free the hostages.
So it's just not clear yet, but if I could find a way to take those hostages, get them, and bring them out, and that required using the military force of the United States, make no mistake about it, I would do it in an instant.
Bush said he would have to weigh the risks to U.S. forces that would be involved. Renewing his appeal for assistance from the new leaders in Tehran, Bush said we don't have to be hostile with Iran for the rest of our lives. Authorities in Ethiopia have recovered the bodies of all 16 people killed in the crash of a plane carrying Representative Mickey Leland of Texas. A helicopter hovered near a sheer cliff in southwestern Ethiopia as the bodies were hoisted up one by one from the rugged mountainside where the twin-engine plane crashed last week. A Marine spokesman said it may take a week for the bodies to be identified. A team of Air Force investigators has arrived from Washington to work with Ethiopian authorities to determine the cause of the accident. The state of Alaska has filed its long-awaited lawsuit over the Exxon Valdez oil spill. In addition to Exxon, the suit names six other oil companies that jointly own the Alaska pipeline and seek damages that could total billions of dollars. Peter Kenyon with Alaska Public Radio reports.
The 42-page suit filed in Anchorage Superior Court asks for actual, compensatory, and punitive damages in the wake of the nation's worst oil spill. And the scope of the suit is broader than expected, naming not only Exxon and the Alyeska Pipeline Company, but every major oil producer in Alaska. State oil spill coordinator Robert Laresh told reporters that the company systematically stripped Alyeska of its ability to deal with the major spill.
We feel that Alyeska as a corporation was merely a sham, a corporate shell, if you will, behind which these partners have been hiding for the last 12 or 15 years.
No dollar figure is quoted in the suit, but Laresh said the damages could reach into the multiple billions of dollars. For National Public Radio, I'm Peter Kenyon in Juneau, Alaska.
The military says a Trident II missile was destroyed shortly after launch from a submerged nuclear submarine off the Florida coast today. It was the second major setback for the Navy's most powerful weapon in three trials at sea. The three-stage missile was fired from the USS Tennessee while the giant submarine was cruising about 50 feet below the surface of the Atlantic Ocean, some 200 miles east of Cape Canaveral. Officials at Edwards Air Force Base say the second flight of the B-2 stealth bomber was scrubbed today because of minor glitches. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 9.67 points to finish at 2687.59. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air.
People, if I could have your attention, please. Sorry to bum you out again so soon after the brown acid, but we've just discovered that some of you may have taken something without knowing it. What's really weird is you won't start coming onto it for years. But when you do, we want you to be calm and remember what you're going through right now, because this stuff's called Woodstock nostalgia, and we hear it can really be a bummer.
We don't know what kind of reaction you're having, but our rock and roll historian Ed Ward is practically breaking out in hives with all the nostalgia about the 20th anniversary of Woodstock, how it brought a generation together, how everything was free and easy. Ed says, take off those rose-colored glasses.
Probably the stupidest book title I've seen in a while is Jack Curry's Woodstock, The Summer of Our Lives. Now, I wasn't at Woodstock, and I realize that summer's not a physical ordeal for many people in the way it is for us down here in Texas. But just considering the metaphorical implications of that title makes me ill. Summer suggests warmth, youth, and ripeness. What comes after is aging, cooling, and death. And what really scares me is that there are actually people out there who will buy that metaphor. I'll tell you what I remember about Woodstock. In the summer of 1969, I was teaching a course in the history of popular music at a small Midwestern college. A bunch of my students announced one week that they were going to miss a couple of classes because they were going to Woodstock. I told them that was fine, but you couldn't drag me to a thing like that. First, I told them, mistaking upstate New York for the Lower East Side, the cops would be all over them, breaking their heads. And even if that didn't happen, the sound would be awful, and you wouldn't be able to make much sense out of the music that was being played. When they staggered back on Wednesday, they told me that I was too paranoid about the cops, which I was, but otherwise it was much worse than I had envisioned. The weather had seen to that. Woodstock, a friend of mine reminded me a few weeks ago, was one of the first examples of the media reshaping an event to the point of making people remember things that never happened. Remember the beautiful harmonies of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young? Because they were awful. The feeble attempt we just heard was overdubbed in the studio later. The group never did really understand the least thing about harmony singing, but they made sure they'd sound good in the film. As for the rest of the music, all too much of it was the sort of grandstanding, boring tripe purveyed by guitarist Alvin Lee of 10 Years After. Much of the talent was negligible. Melanie Safka? Quill? Mountain? Give me a break. Some of the better acts put on horrible performances, most notably the Grateful Dead, who were getting ready to fire their keyboard player, and Janis Joplin, who was so zonked on heroin she could barely stand up. Other performances that were highly thought of then bring a shiver today. How about Grace Slick braying in front of the Jefferson Airplane, or The Who performing that epic of stultifying boredom, Tommy? Okay, hold it, I hear you say. Woodstock wasn't about the music that was played there. Given all the confusion, the fact that it came off at all was enough of a miracle. Fine, I'll agree with you there. The workers who put that show on did a heroic job, and no, the actual musical quality didn't count, not really. No, Woodstock was really about something far more insidious than bad music. It was a celebration, not of peace, love, and music, as its slogan said, but of the destruction of a cultural movement by a handful of its participants and originators. It marked the delivery of the hippie culture that had been growing in American England for the past 4 years into the hands of commercial forces who could mass market it and sell it back to those who had made it happen. It marked the end of a culture where the barrier between creators and consumers barely existed, and the beginning of one where creation was equated with spectacle, and the consumers were passive and paid for the privilege of watching it. It marked the end of an ethic of sharing, be it of dope, food, or services, and the beginning of a more hard-edged, profit-oriented, every-man-for-himself way of looking at the world and its bounty. And although cynical nostalgists are trying to sell you on the fact that it was the height of the 60s, it was, in fact, the last nail in the coffin. Perhaps it's the fate of mass movements to end like this, and yet this one seems to have embraced its end without a whimper. Anybody who'd say that Woodstock marked the summer of their life hasn't been paying attention. The only person who seemed to intuit what was happening, however dimly, was the one who played the only piece of music that everybody still agrees was a masterpiece. I should let him have the last word.
This is Fresh Air. Novelist Don DeLillo doesn't usually like to talk about his writing. He says most of his novels tend to be elusive and abstract. But he talked about his novel Libra, he says, because Libra is grounded in reality, the assassination of President Kennedy. The book is now out in paperback. DeLillo's novel White Noise won the 1985 American Book Award, and while writing it, DeLillo wrote a non-fiction essay for Rolling Stone about the Kennedy assassination, which drew him into the events of 1963. Although we know the outcome of the story that unfolds in his book Libra, DeLillo says too much has been left to speculation.
We don't know the details of the story. We don't know what the characters were thinking. We don't know some of the links between characters. These are the gaps I tried to fill in. Beyond that, I think a work of fiction that resolves some of the unanswered questions may be one way for people to soften the edges of their dissatisfaction with the past. There's a sense in which fiction can rescue history from its confusions.
What was it about Lee Harvey Oswald that fascinated you as a writer?
Well, probably the fact that he was an outsider, the fact that he harbored contradictions. He was double-dealing, self-pitying, violent, cruel. But he was also battered by his attempts to make his way in the world. I think he was the classic Libran, at least in theory. He leaned one way, but ended up acting another. He tilted one way, ended up acting another.
In the book, you make him a very sympathetic character, and perhaps that's just because we see him more as a human being than just a figure being shot in a hallway.
Well, that's all it is. I tried to portray the man as completely as I possibly could, and I tried to stay as close to the real Oswald as I understood him to be. If he's sympathetic, perhaps the reader is supplying this emotion. I tried to be as even-handed as possible. Certainly, Oswald is no victim. He's the gunman.
But he also seems, in many ways, allowing himself to be pushed around. You talk about, I get the sense, destiny is a cop-out. You know, if we make that green light, if you get in, then you must act, you must shoot, otherwise you're not destined to do it. That seems to be a thought that goes through Lee Oswald's mind and through Jack Ruby's mind and even some of the CIA characters you've created.
Well, I think there is a strong element of passivity in Oswald's makeup. I think there is a point at which he stopped trying to exert his influence on his immediate surroundings and simply waited for whatever would happen. And I think this may have been an element in his decision to shoot at the president. I think the motivating force was the sheer coincidence of the fact that the president's motorcade would be passing beneath his window, and exactly at the time when he was most likely to be alone on the sixth floor. This must have been a powerful influence on his decision to take his rifle to work that day.
What was the nature of the research that you did? There's a character in your stories, Nicholas Branch, a retired CIA man who's writing a secret history. He talks about being overwhelmed with paper slipping out the door. There are details, there's minutia. Was that Don DeLillo writing this book?
Well, to a limited extent. The main source of my work was the Warren Report, the summary volume and the 26 accompanying volumes of testimony and exhibits. And together they comprise a kind of encyclopedia of daily life. Dental records, postcards, report cards, old newspapers. They're very evocative, not only of the period, the late 50s and early 60s, but of many of the people who are part of the assassination archives.
Well, in many ways, did this make your research as a novelist easier? You didn't have to make up details? I mean, all the details were right there.
Yes, the details did drive the work. They provided a sense of propulsion to my day-to-day routine. There's no doubt about it.
You described the assassination as 7 seconds that broke the back of the century. Could you explain, what did that do for your writing, too, that date in 1963?
In some ways, it's possible that that single event made me the kind of writer I turned out to be. Certainly, I was not a fully formed writer at that stage. I was 26 or 27 years old and had only published some short stories and small quarterlies. As time went by and as I began to find my voice as a writer, I began to realize it was something of a dark voice and that my books had a dark tone. I don't think it's out of the question that the assassination, in part at least, was responsible for this. And so, in a sense, I suppose, Libra is a culmination for me.
You've written or said somewhere that paranoia seems to be the most reasonable approach to life in our times. Do you live your life that way?
No, I'm not paranoid at all. I can't conceive of writing a book about the assassination without recognizing the element of paranoia which seems to have entered our lives as a result of that 7 seconds. What seems missing in the past 25 years is the sense of a coherent reality most of us shared. We seem to have entered a world of paranoia and ambiguity and randomness. A character in the book calls this an aberration in the heartland of the real. Even after all these years, we're not agreed on the number of gunmen, the number of shots, the origin of the shots, the paths the bullets took, the number of wounds on the president's body, and the list goes on and on. Beyond this, I think we've developed a sense of the secret manipulation of history. Documents lost or destroyed, official records sealed for 25 or 50 years, a number of very suggestive murders and suicides.
And what about your private thoughts, sort of in the middle of the night as you were working on the project? Would you begin to dream of these people?
I thought about them all the time. I still think about them, particularly Oswald himself. And he certainly entered my consciousness. I don't think I'll ever get rid of him, really. He's stuck to me for life.
In part of Libra, you describe the intersection that Oswald and Kennedy have, that eventually these lines will cross. Your line seems to have been a third one.
Well, it's odd, but Lee Oswald and I lived 6 or 7 blocks from each other in the Bronx in 1953. He and his mother traveled to New York because his oldest brother, actually his half-brother, was stationed at Ellis Island with the Coast Guard. And so they lived near the Bronx Zoo for about a year at the same time that I lived just a short distance away. He was 13 years old at the time, and I was 16.
So you feel a chronological closeness, a proximity to him?
Not exactly, but the very coincidence gave me a kind of personal nudge toward doing the book.
You seem to want to step aside from the whole literary world of selling and of merchandising books, and you release a book to the world, and then you go back and write in privacy again from within your room. That was one thing that struck me about Oswald. He was always coming back down to one small room, a small closet.
I suppose that's one reason why I was interested in Oswald. He seemed to live his life in small, cramped rooms. And in fact, this is a theme which runs through my work. There seems to be someone confronting himself in a room somewhere in all my novels. And I found it interesting that I would eventually come upon a real person who lived that same kind of pared-down existence I had created for purely fictional characters.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Don DeLillo's book Libra, now in paperback, is published by Viking Penguin. Here's an excerpt. He stood at the southeast window, inside a barrier of curtains. The larger ones formed a wall about 5 feet high and carried a memory with them, a sense of a kid's snug hideout, making him feel apart and secure. Inside the barrier were four more cartons, one set lengthwise on the floor, two stacked, one small carton resting on the brick windowsill, a bench, a support, a gun rest. The wrapping paper he'd used to conceal the rifle was on the floor near his feet. Dust, broken spider webs hanging from the ceiling. He saw a dime on the floor. He picked it up and put it in his pocket. He looked down Houston Street as the motorcade approached, slow and vivid in the sun. There were people scattered on the lawns of Daly Plaza, maybe 150, many with cameras. He held the rifle at port arms, more or less, and stood in plain view in the tall window. Everything looked so painfully clear. The president had chestnut hair, and the first lady was radiant in a pink suit and a small round hat. Lee was glad she looked so good, for her own sake, for the cameras, for the pictures that would enter the permanent record. He spotted Governor John Connally in one of the jump seats, a Stetson in his lap. He liked Connally's face, a rugged Texas face. This was the kind of man who would take a liking to Lee if he ever got to know him. Cartons stamped books. 10 rolling readers. Everyone was grateful for the weather. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up later today here on National Public Radio. Let's check in with host Robert Siegel. You in good health today?
I am in fine health, and we'll be hearing about the Canadian healthcare system once again. Part two of Patricia Naiman. You want to hear a big secret?
Sure.
We call her Patty on the inside. Patty Naiman series comparing Canadian healthcare and American healthcare. There's universal insurance. Up north, and this evening we hear what kind of medical care it gets them. Seems to be pretty good. We'll also be hearing about President Bush's press conference this morning, and a little interesting twist. We'll have a report, which will include the president's most newsworthy answers, but we'll also have another one on the most noteworthy questions.
Enlightening and exclusive, as always. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more here on National Public Radio. The Afternoon of the Writer is a new novel about the craft of writing by Austrian author Peter Handke. Book critic John Leonard found it illuminating.
Peter Handke's first novel, The Goalie's Anxiety at the Penalty Kick, and his semi-fictionalized memoir of his mother's suicide, A Sorrow Beyond Dreams, were both brilliant. Since then, the Austrian novelist, poet, playwright, and translator seems to me to have been painting himself into a corner and then complaining that he couldn't move. His books got thinner and more exasperating. So what if language itself were the secret hero of listless narratives like A Moment of True Feeling, The Left-Handed Woman, and Repetition? We've been there before, at this impasse, in this trap, in the superior company of Kafka and Rilke and Sartre. I found myself preferring Handke's collaborations with the filmmaker Wim Wenders. At least in the movies, all that language was attached to something I could look at, even if what I was looking at was urban masochism. Handke's latest, The Afternoon of the Writer, is a reproach and a reminder. We go on reading these complicated Europeans through their depressive phases until they finally get it right, and then we're dazzled. A nameless writer in a nameless European city leaves the warmth of his room and his cat for a December walk among the ruins. He crosses bridges, looks into windows, stops at a cafe, reads a newspaper and a letter, meets a couple of colleagues, witnesses an accident. The city itself is language, with its distance and its limits, its concentrated din of traffic coming from all directions, comparable to the region on the fringe of dreams. This city of language assails him with humming and fragments, a hodgepodge of dots and spirals, wavy lines and mutilated cuneiform, musical intervals, whispering sibilants, chords and squeaks and silence. He finds himself in a bar, on trial, accused of lying. His work is charged with being something in which material is next to nothing, structure almost everything, something that rotates on its axis without the help of a flywheel, something whose elements hold one another in suspension, which cannot be worn out by use. He stands for what the crowd detests, daydreaming, handmade writing, dissent, and ultimately art. Against this city, there is another language, his own weather, the seasons of his dreaming. The snow, he thinks, in the air could have been flying seeds. The snow on the ground could have been fallen blossoms. The rounding of the image gave emptiness a radiance. At a deserted playground, a swing still moves in emptiness. The writer watched it until the after effect of the child's motion had dwindled to a mere trembling of ropes in the snowy wind. Emptiness, my guiding principle, my beloved. If emptiness is the writer's beloved, slowness is his illumination. Why, he asks, had no one ever invented a god of slowness? I can't tell you how this writer, out of dreaminess and namelessness, the city and the weather, manages to reaffirm his vocation. He is dreaming this book. I can only tell you that the writer's vocation, a puzzle of the self, a long-forgotten wonderment, has never before been so wonderfully affirmed, not even at the end of Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. Carry on, he tells himself. Portray, transmit, continue to work the most ephemeral of materials, my breath, be its craftsman.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Afternoon of the Writer by Peter Hanke. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. Terry Gross is on vacation reading for pleasure for a couple of weeks. I'm Sedge Thompson.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we examine our place in the great big cosmos with astronomer Timothy Ferris, who produced the recording of Earth sounds that's aboard Voyager and now passing Neptune. Also, reporter and novelist Ron Taylor talks about his novel, Long Road Home. I'm Sedge Thompson. I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.